Chapter 64.
It can't be that big, was Kip's first thought, as he first saw Dunvio in the low light. From his maps and many descriptions of it, Kip knew exactly what Dunvio looked like. But as with so many things in life, there's a difference between knowing and knowing. Unlike most cities, there had been only a few buildings outside the walls. The population of Dunvio had shrunk so much over the years, and been so huge before the Chromeria's rise, that land inside the walls was cheap. The inns and food stalls that had set themselves up outside the walls for the convenience of travellers had been burnt or cannibalised for lumber and stone by the blood-robed besiegers months ago. It made for an odd scene. The attackers set up in a wide crescent around the walls, amid the great stumps of all the trees they'd cleared, their boats anchored in a neat crescent outside the river gate, and then the vast, incomprehensible greenery of the wall itself. Kip had seen the creation of one of the wonders of the world in Brightwater Wall, but the green wall surrounding Dunvio was something on a completely different scale. Kip had assumed Green Wall was a screen of impressive trees in front of a wall itself, when told the trees were the wall. He thought there must be fortifications stretched between each tree. That was wrong, too. Massive Sabino cypresses made towers to heaven every 30 paces, and the gaps between them were filled with millennial cypress and other trees, trunk to straining trunk, growing more thickly than should have been possible, and also more closely to their neighbours. But no branches hung out into the space over the invaders. Every limb had instead grown back into the mass of the wall itself, as if guided by some Colonian intelligence to make it impregnable. Over and through all the massive trees grew ivies and vines, further binding the trees together and clogging the spaces between them, but their leaves also gave the defenders perfect cover. An archer would part the leaves, take a shot through the makeshift murder hole, and then disappear, leaving not so much as a target. The impression of the hole was of a green cataract, as far as the eye could see, cascading in every direction, as if it were the old god's own verdant fountain. Flowers were sprouted everywhere, not deigning to accept the mortals' war going on beneath them. In some places, the ivies had been burnt or pulled down in previous sallies, but it had done little. In fact, against the mammoth height of the tree wall, the tiny scars only made the efforts of man seem paltry and impotent.
Time, Farkudi said.
In their months fighting together, Ben-Hadad had fashioned clocks with deliberately weird intervals for each Nightbringer captain's superviolet drafter. Kip didn't need a clock to count out the 6-minute and 37-second interval they were using today. Farkudi counted it in his head, all the time, without apparent distraction or even effort. Sometimes Kip wanted to kiss the big dope. He threw up a superviolet flare in the pre-dawn gloom. For a long time, nothing seemed to happen. Then Kip saw the answering superviolet flare. The nightmares were in place in the woods.
Time, Farkudi said.
Around him, Kip saw men and women silently making the sign of the seven, preparing their immortal souls and hoping they wouldn't find out if they had immortal souls today. Here we go. Kip gestured, and they released the firebirds. It had taken the Willcasters and Paraturgs a long time to figure out how to set birds on fire without actually burning them, but the ghosts absolutely refused to intentionally harm the animals they partnered with. It was war, harm happened, but they did absolutely everything they could to avoid it. The firebirds went up in a broad fan in front of Kip and his lines, perfectly paced. Their charges burnt for 10 seconds and then winked out. Before they were all gone, 4,000 throats roared, and fires went up all along Kip's lines. Narrow trenches filled with pyre jelly had been cut between each of the widely spaced lines, and they lit with a satisfying whoosh in long, deep streaks, as if a dragon had clawed the forest itself with talons of fire. Then each man and woman dipped their torches, 2 for each, into the flames. 8,000 torches to make it look as if they had 8,000 soldiers. For Kip had ordered that even the camp followers should march behind the army to appear to be part of it. Everyone could carry a couple of torches. The Blood Robes officers would know the numbers were wrong, were impossible, but the men would see those supposedly impossible numbers with their own eyes. Once a man is convinced to believe the impossible, it's impossible to make him disbelieve it. The pagan army was spread red and black across the floodplain to Kip's sub-red vision. Only its commanders held torches. General Amrit Kamal, the lord of the air who led the enemy, had lined up his people in what had become a standard battle formation for the Blood Robes. centuries, each literally 100 men, arrayed in lines. Battalions comprised of 6 centuries were deployed 100 men wide and 6 lines deep. Between each 2 battalions was a century of drafters. These, being so much more rare, were deployed in 4 lines of 24 men each, but only half of each drafting platoon was made up of drafters. Each drafter was paired with a shield bearer whose main duty was defending his drafter with a massive tower shield that took both hands to hold. Each shield bearer also carried a pistol, a knife, and a bichoir, or a punch dagger that could be mounted on the wrist without interfering with their grip. The tower shields had a spiked bottom so they could be stabbed into the ground to provide cover. Sometimes whites led the drafter centuries, blues or superviolets, or yellows predominantly. Like the greens, orange and red and sub-red whites were generally uncontrollable, and were instead unleashed to fight alone where they willed. Kip's army was facing Kamal's 6 battalions and 6 drafter centuries. Probably an elite battalion was being held in reserve back at the camp, where the blurriness of sub-red vision couldn't even make it out against the darkness. So, just as reported, Kamal had more than 4,000 men. Against Kip's 2,000. But Kip had the ghosts. Talak came out of the woods behind Kip, wearing his special howdah harness. Kruxa floated up into his place with that infuriating grace of his. He'd decided Kip didn't get to ride into battle alone ever again. Talak didn't seem to even notice the additional weight. Putting on spectacles, Kip looked a question at Talak. "You ready?" And the giant grizzly woofed. He was. Kip mounted the howdah beside Kruxa and motioned for the bonfires behind him to be lit. Then Talak stood on his hind legs, lifting Kip and Kruxa high in the air. The bonfire behind them made a huge silhouette for the enemy to see. Then Kip threw fire into the air from his own hands, and his forces advanced. Kip and Talak advanced more slowly than the rest. No need to put himself at risk too early. They were supposed to be a distraction. He didn't want to arrive in musket or bow range before the battle was joined. That was the problem with arriving in battle on the back of a huge-ass bear. You made a huge-ass target. His own soldiers were deployed in Kip's modification of General Danavis's model. The modifications had not been made because Kip thought he was an equal of the legend, but because he had an embarrassment of riches in having so many drafters. Danavis's armies had maybe 1 warrior drafter for every 50 soldiers. Kip had 1 for every 10, and that wasn't counting the nightmares. A trumpet blew amid the enemy lines, and Kip saw the back 2 lines of each of Kamal's battalions peel off to march to either side of the blood robes' already wide lines. They meant their wider lines to curl around Kip's lines and crush them from the sides. It was a pretty standard maneuver when you had twice as many men as your enemy did. So the officers hadn't been fooled. It meant the blood robes were sticking with their own battle plan, despite Kip's gambit with the torches. If Kip wanted his lines to be as wide as theirs, he'd have to literally stretch his men thin and meet Kamal's 4-man-deep lines with his own lines only 2-men-deep. Their going only 4-deep was risky. His going 2-deep would be insanity. It was a trap, but not the obvious one. No sane commander in his position would try to fight only 2 men deep. Instead, a sane commander would try to punch through the blood robe lines, hoping to break through the 4 lines in a sharp move. What else could he do? He couldn't match the width of their lines and couldn't allow them to turn his flank, so instead he would draw his men in to hit their center hard and try to break their lines fast before the encircling maneuver killed them all. Not today. When his nightbringers reached the appointed places, their commandos bellowed, and they stopped dead, as they'd planned. Except that not all of Kip's men stopped as they'd been commanded, because glory is to young idiots as a mountain of poppy is to the lotus eater. Ignoring the screams of their commanders, several dozen men tore away from Kip's lines and ran forward, screaming. Because war is a fat whore who rolls over on her babies in the night. "What the hell are those idiots doing?" Kruxa asked. "Weeding themselves out of my army," Kip said, furious. The turtle bear tattoo on his arm lighting up in angry red, Kip hurled out his signals, but now in fire. "Hold! Hold!" The men who'd broken away ran heedless, and all Kip could do was pray that they died quickly so that their friends didn't follow them trying to save them. He could sense others on the verge of breaking. Everyone knew that if they didn't follow those young fools, the fools would die. Kip's commanders were screaming, even firing their muskets in the air to try to draw their men's eyes to them lest they break. Then an explosion rocked the field, and one of the charging idiots simply disappeared in fire, as if he'd stood on the barrel of a musket aimed at the heavens. An instant later, another hit another of the buried charges and was flung skyward. Only half of him landed. Not even the war dogs had smelled the charges. The Cooney War's dogs were bred to fight, and while they could smell more acutely than any man by far, their abilities were one compared to those of the two scent hounds the Willcasters had brought. It was two hounds who would save Kip's entire army. The charges had been buried weeks before, the smell of their Luxin covered so well that they had been noticed only when the hounds' human partners reported that a certain area of ground had no scent of human passage at all. That had led their commanders, Kip hadn't even known about it until the deed was done, to scour the ground three nights in a row, dodging patrols and, unknowing at the time, the buried charges, in order to discern the trap. Kip watched the 20 men die with cold command. He had no pity for men who were willing to trade their friends' deaths and their commanders' plans for their own glory. He watched them die in blood and fire, men screaming with blown-off feet and partial faces. Mostly, he noted which charges had been exploded. He had a partial map of them, not a full one, so it was probably wasted effort, but you never knew. One fool panicked as he saw his compatriots die. He turned and tried to run back in his own footprints. Another improbably made it through the mines and within 20 paces of the enemy lines. Somehow, every shot in the first volley of at least 20 muskets had missed the man. But two miracles was as many as a man could ask in 1 minute. The next volley, guns and magic both, levelled the man as he came within 10 paces. It had happened soon enough that none of their friends followed them. Thank Orholm. The killing ground in the middle of the battlefield was limited, and the Blood Robes naturally knew exactly how far it extended. It had been their trap, hoping Kip would race into the minefield as he tried to break their lines. Kamal's Blood Robes stopped their advance in the middle so as not to trample on their own charges, but their broad flanks extended around each side. Those continued their enveloping tactics. Kip's drafters didn't waste any time. Those at the centre of his line, knowing they were against a minefield and not soldiers, hadn't been carrying many weapons. Instead, they'd been lugging slabs of Luxin in pairs, green over yellow, 3 feet wide and 5 feet tall. Another crazy invention Ben-Hadad's corps of engineers had come up with, a portable wall. Under musket fire, the men now stabbed the sections of the portable wall into the soil in rapid succession, from left to right, each section fitting perfectly into the next. Meanwhile, Kip's Reds threw out long streams of power jelly, which a moment later sub-Reds set fire to. The killing field was now visibly delineated for Kip's men. Don't go in here. But now the Nightbringers' flanks, which had stopped too, faced enemy lines deeper than their own and far wider. They collapsed before they even came in contact with the Blood Robes. As the Blood Robe cavalry advanced, completing its flanking maneuver, the Nightbringers' torch-carrying camp followers were revealed to be civilians, betrayed by the swelling light of the rising sun as the cavalry came nearer. The men and women fled toward the forest, many dropping their torches. There was now nothing between Kip's camp in the woods and the Blood Robe cavalry, except fleeing civilians. The sight of those fleeing did to the cavalry what fleeing prey does to any predator. Hundreds surged forward, eager for killing and plunder. Their commanders didn't even try to stop them. "Hold!" Kip shouted. That was the signal. With the sun nearing dawn, he'd caught sight of a broad form pulling itself out of the river behind the Blood Robes. Tullock tossed his head and Kip sawed at the reins they'd tied to his jaws. The reins were purely for show. Kip never used reins. The immediacy of command would have actually been nice, but the bear wouldn't stand for it. Kip shot superviolet signals out and his men started screaming, collapsing back farther. The infantry lines were closing in on the sides and Tullock seemed unnerved by the charging men. "Hold, Tullock! Hold!" Kip shouted, and the bear bolted. Kip dropped his sword and crux of his spear, and they simply held on. Tullock bounded away from his army, fleeing into the forest. He heard a cheer from the Blood Robes as they saw Kip's army lose its commander. In between surprisingly fluid bounds, Kip saw his gambit unfolding in the forest. They'd put the fleetest of foot at the front of the line, making the young men and women the last people to get to flee from the cavalry. They'd also armed them with grenades. The civilians had followed orders better than the hotheads in Kip's lines and had run all the way to the cover of the forest before turning and throwing the grenades. Some ran too slow, though, and were run down. Some panicked and didn't stop at all, forgetting their weapons and their orders, but Kip had figured that would happen. He'd armed them with grenades mostly to bolster the courage of those who were the bait for the trap. Nonetheless, Kip saw a number of them turn and hurl the hand-sized bombs at their pursuers. One hit a tree not 2 paces away from herself, and she was shredded by shrapnel. Another hit a horse and blew off its leg. Its careening body planted its rider headfirst into another tree, crunching him down to half his original height. Others missed and turned to run again. Not far into the woods, which were significantly darker in the dawning light than the treeless floodplain, the nightmares sprang their trap. First came the smoke. Charges went off with dull thuds, disorienting the charging cavalry and blocking the view of what was happening to them from their army. Wolves and panthers and mountain lions pounced from rocks and tree limbs and hidden hollows. The civilians had their own traps, deeper, in case any of the cavalry got that far, but Kip saw none of those. Tullock's path cut back into the forest and then along its front edge, hopefully just out of sight of the blood robes on the plain. One straggler from the cavalry was slow enough to be in their path, and Tullock elongated his bounds and slashed one huge paw as they went behind the horse. His blade-lined claws caught only the head and shoulders of the rider. Con Arthur hated killing horses. The horse staggered for one step and then stood. The rider slumped and tumbled out of the saddle, his head and one arm torn completely off. Tullock had barely even broken stride. They emerged from the woods, hundreds of paces west of where they'd entered. The disposition of the battlefield had changed utterly. In the minute or three, Kip and Cruxer had been gone. As ordered, the Nightbringers had collapsed into a tight, packed square. They were surrounded on all sides by the blood robes, and held only because of the Luxin walls they'd so hurriedly assembled. Men deeper in the formation were reloading muskets and passing them forward again. It was perhaps the first time in military history that muskets were being used to good effect, after the first shock of an infantry charge. But the numbers were still too lopsided. They'd held out this long only because the cavalry had been drawn away. And now the Blood Robes reinforcement battalion was coming in. Their cavalry was lowering their lances and charging. A signal flare went up from a white near the killing field. The white had disarmed the Blood Robes' explosives. Damn it. Kip's timing was off by just that much. Lorcan had needed to hit them 30 seconds ago. But then he saw Lorcan. Somehow, in the screaming and their tunnel vision toward the enemies in front of them, the Blood Robes hadn't seen him yet. The huge bear plunged into the back ranks of the infantry reinforcements running across the plain. He sank deep, deep into the heart of the infantry formation before they even saw him. They were jogging forward, the front lines already breaking into a run, so in moments it became utter chaos. Men shrieking in fear, Lorcan roaring, and metal rending with every swipe of his big paws. Men were hurled bodily into the air. Commanders shouted unheard over the melee. Meanwhile, the charging cavalry hurtled across the killing ground. Not a single charge went off, but that side of the square was ready for them. A cloud of black smoke was vomited out into the air, streaked with green and golden lights, and lit from within by streams of liquid fire. The first rank of the cavalry didn't even make it to the Nightbringer's line, obliterated by hot lead and magic, and the second rank was appreciably thinned. The third rank hurtled past them, and the fourth and fifth had to leap over the fallen. But many made it through. They crashed into the Luxin wall, lances extended. They'd expected a shield wall, though, not an actual wall. Each section was not only physically linked to the others on each side, but also braced against the force of their charge with long diagonal supports. Some few sections buckled, but most held. Men flipped off horses brought to a dead halt and toppled into the square where the Nightbringers waited with axes and daggers. Three red whites, riding in the fourth rank of the cavalry, leapt off their horses as they crashed into the mass of their friends and foes. Tumbling through the air, they blasted through the petty attempts to swat them aside. Kip had set the fastest drafters to knock grenades out of the air. When the whites landed, they hurled death in every direction, but each white was quickly brought down. The last ranks of cavalry broke off the charge, seeing they'd only cripple and kill their own. But that was when Kip and Tullock entered the fray. They hit the cavalry from the rear quarter. The men turned to see that their own infantry, which was supposed to support them, had melted behind them instead, and two giant grizzlies were tearing them apart. The other battalion's cavalry had gone into the woods and not reappeared. It was too many shocks at once for men trapped between a wall and a giant grizzly ridden by a man throwing fire down on their heads. Panic spread faster than the flames. They broke in every direction. Tullock gave a few more swipes at those nearest him, then halted at Kip's signal, and as quickly as it had begun, Kip's fight was over. Now he was a general again. He began throwing flaming signals at once. The tight square unfolded, pursuing the blood robes. Most of them headed toward the forest where the nightmares awaited. A few were headed too far east or west, but Kip's men drove them as sheepdogs drive sheep, a little barking here, a little nipping at the heels there, and they turned back to where Kip wanted them, like mindless animals. The other blood robes ran toward their own camp and the walls. Kip sent more than half his forces after those, under Derwin Aleph. He knew what to do. Lorcan was deep in their camp. It wasn't where Kip wanted him, but he was beyond orders now. Kip only hoped that in its rage, the Great Bear wouldn't kill any Nightbringers. He started toward the city walls himself, and the actual horses and ponies of the Nightmares fell in with him. A rout had started from the Blood Robes camp. General Kamal's staff, his bodyguards, their servants and families, these were the people who could see the noose dropping over their necks. They knew that if they got trapped against the river, they'd not stand a chance. So they ran the other way. If they could make it past the hulking form of Greenwall and its archers, they could escape. It became a race, Kip and the Nightmares trying to head them off before they cleared the walls. But within half a minute it became clear it wouldn't be much of a contest. The archers lining the walls rained down shots on the fleeing blood robes, mostly missing but killing a few and injuring more, slowing those who stopped to help them. The line elongated and separated completely. Those with horses abandoned the others. But Dunvio was fast, and Kip and the Mighty had the angle. They reached it 100 paces before the end of the wall. Now if those idiots up on the wall can just not shoot us. It was a thought without rancor. Men long bored and suddenly excited who held weapons in their hands could get careless with whom they pointed them at. On reaching the wall, Tullock wheeled and stood on his hind legs. He roared fury. Tullock didn't want to be here. He wanted to be with his brother. Musket fire and explosions from the camp and the lack of Lorcan's reappearance didn't bode well for how Con Arthur's brother was doing. "Halt! Halt!" the man mounted at the lead shouted to his bodyguards. Man might have been generous. He was a blue-white, dressed in gaudy gold robes, skin sparkling with facets like snake scales. "Lord Gael! Lord Kip Gael!" the white shouted, holding his hand up. Tullock dropped back to all fours and roared again. The Mighty thundered in to surround Kip, even as Lord Kamal's own bodyguards surrounded him in a sudden flood.
"Lord Gael! I, Amrit Kamal, Lord of the Air, do challenge you to a duel."
His men were hurriedly reloading muskets they discharged in the fighting. "Yeah, no," Kip said. The Mighty fired their muskets immediately, perforating the Lord of the Air in as many places as possible. Waves of fire and missiles followed before Lord Kamal's bodyguards could counterattack. That was enough for everyone else behind Lord Kamal. They doubled back, and fleeing made easy prey for the Mighty. The Mighty hadn't been able to do much fighting in this battle, and they were eager to make up for lost time.